Maybe you came across that quote of what's his name, Marshall McLuhan, recently floated around, and he said that the English word reading, right?
Oh yeah, I know that quote. Yeah.
The English word reading comes from the old German word Ratan, also Raten, which means guessing.
Yep.
And so reading is in itself guessing, because it's like you have innumerable ways of interpreting a word, a sentence, a paragraph, and you never know. There is no. So I was reading. I'm telling you. I'm reading this book about Lacan from Zizek, and Zizek and Lacan says there is no sexual relationship. There is no, because everybody has their fantasies to keep the whole thing going. There's never like a way where these two fantasies kind of meet. And the same thing between author and reader, those two shall never meet, because as a reader, you're confined to guessing.
Oh, that's cool that you brought that up, because I've been thinking about McLuhan recently as well in relationship to our discussion about YouTube versus audio, right?
Right.
So reading, according to McLuhan, yes, I remember that quote very well in that discussion. Reading is a cold media. In other words, it requires interpretation, and it requires understanding multiple contexts. As it requires a lot of activity on the part of the reader. You have to fill in all the blanks, right? So it's a cool, he calls it a cool media, because it's like Lacan is about as cool a media as you can get, because it's so hard to understand. You have to just like, you have to put all of your attention into understanding it.
Yeah.
So he's as a medium. It's very interesting. He's talking about just the effect, right?
Yeah.
Of reading Lacan, regardless of the content. Let's say you just ignore the content of Lacan for a second, and just the effect of reading Lacan is intense concentration, you know, to, you know, concepts that might be very obscure to you. So I was thinking about, I was thinking about the difference between podcasting and YouTube, and podcasting is a cool medium. It's people always speak with a cool voice and very calm, and you know, you can follow and while you're, you know, listening, while you're doing something else, but it's much cooler of a medium. So the voices that are big in YouTube are guys with podcasting are guys that have cool, mellow, you know, the NPR voice, whereas in YouTube, it's always the hot headed, you know, rash, crazy types. Like Jordan Peterson, Joe Rogan, who are just sort of shouting about things but you also have the visual of them. So you see their mannerisms and their body, and so you're much more immediate. There's much more salience. You're much more immediately drawn in to a YouTube video than you are to a podcast. It's a podcast is a cooler experience versus, a hot experience. So I think the whole Lacanian Hegelian world is like about as cool and cold even as you could get, you know, as opposed to like other writers like Camille Paglia, or even our friend Alexander Bard. It's hot media, which grabs your attention and grabs you by the balls, so to speak.
Yeah. It's interesting because Zizek says in that book about Lacan that Lacan was not a postmodernist, and he refused to be called a postmodernist.
Yeah.
Yet his writing is so opaque that you're like kind of lost in the beginning. And so you have to create your whole system of interpretation of what a certain text means. And it's the same thing is kind of true. It's like a cold reading, you know, when Orson Welles talks about a cold reading, or mentalists talk about cold. So you have no prior conceptions of what the text might be. And I like that about podcasting as well. So you have to be in a state of hypnosis to try to, with your left brain, to create a web of meaning. You know,
yeah, that's
but
it.
But if that web of meaning is actually that what the author intended, that nobody knows that. And, you know, last point, I liked what Cadell said in one of the last episodes, like you have to be like a tiger to approach the text, you know, because it's like you have no prior conceptions about these things, and then you yeah. then you create yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can read a text in two ways. You can read it as a beginner with a beginner mind and just kind of like dive into it and kind of drown in it, in a sense. Or you can bring all your baggage with you.
Yeah.
All your prejudices and your entire system that you've created, your whole training and that kind of thing. I often like the hot texts more. Like, again, as other people I was thinking about was Nietzsche. Nietzsche's very hot.
Yeah.
He doesn't spell everything out for you. He says outrageous things that you want to sometimes punch him for, and other times you want to, like, you know, embrace him.
Yeah.
You know, hot provocation. And so it grabs me. Whereas the other work, because I'm lazy, is harder for me to penetrate. You know, works that are cooler, they require you to slow down, and they require you to fill in all the gaps and make all these webs of associations and that kind of thing. So,
exactly.
So I mean, Marshall McLuhan's major point is, if you pay attention to the effect of these things on your mind, right? YouTube is going to be sort of destabilizing to your mind, and Twitter or something like that. It's like, it's going to get you excited and kind of pissed off and depressed and then angry. It's going to hit your endorphin. Is that it? Whatever it's called. It's going to hit your reactive aspects, the fight and repulsion aspects in your brain. Whereas, if you want to cool down a little bit, you know, just relax and sort of explore something, you explore something that's more cool. Yeah. I mean, I've had to sort of get rid of TV from my life because it swallows me up so completely. I love it. I love television, you know, as a medium, because it's so utterly absorbing and addictive. But in order to get the tasks I need to do in a day and in my complex life, I have to sort of get rid of television from my palate, because it's too hot of a medium.
My issue with Lacan is in that regard, that, you know, you have to, if you read these about these concepts described by Zizek, I have sometimes a hard time to find that within me. You know, sometimes it's like, oh no, I can relate to these different concepts. So when I mentioned this before, when Lacan differentiates between three types of superego, I can understand that. I can find that within my own internal cosmos, let's say.
Yeah.
But there are other things, and then I'm sitting on the terrace and I try to reflect and to internalize and to, I mean, like, rationally I understand what he's trying to say, but I don't find a correlate within my personal cosmos. And then I think, oh no, he's a weirdo, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's my thing, because it's like, you can't read it as a novel, or you can't get hit over the head like a hammer, like with Nietzsche, as Nietzsche does philosophy, and he just shoves your face into the thing he wants to tell you. So he does it differently, but sometimes I don't see it as part of my internal, you get what I'm saying?
You mean like Lacan's a sneaky fucker, sort of?
Yeah, no, he gaslights.
He's sort of gaslighting you with all of his fancy concepts.
Yeah, he's gaslighting, but sometimes there isn't, you know, it's like maybe I have a completely different psychological setup. I don't think so.
Well, perhaps we have to, like, take Kettle's A Crete course, which is like in-depth, reading of his stuff before I could, I want to make any sort of grand statements about Lacan. I've absorbed Lacan like you through Zizek. So what I know about Lacan, I know through Zizek. I don't know the primary material.
But you must know the phenomenon that, I mean, you have a spiritual teacher or a philosopher and they're talking about something and you instantly relate because you discover something within your own cosmos, right?
Yeah, you're set on fire.
What happens if you don't? What happens that even after intense introspection, you don't find what has been pointed to? Then it's like, oh, I'm getting gaslighted here. There's something that's weird.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that?
You feel like you're being raped by the author on some level, right?
Right.
Or manipulated over time. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah. I mean, like when I hear something like petite object or something and everybody gets excited about this fucking thing, and I was like, my problem would be like he makes that into a religious terminology that you have to say in French, right? You have to say right. Petite object you can't say little a object. But in French, petite object there's no poetry in that at all. It's absolutely weird. But maybe that's the point. And you know, I don't want to attack Lacanians because I don't have enough ammunition. I don't have the primary sources.
I don't want to attack anybody. It's just like a phenomenon that I encounter. You know, sometimes when I'm reading books, that it's like maybe it's even the translation, or because it's filtered so many times that I don't find the door, the right access. You know, it's like, but then you read something else describing the phenomenon from a slightly different angle, and then you get it. Yeah. You know, then the door opens, and
In a way, I think Henry Miller had it right. It's like you want these people to be your friends. You know, if they're going to inhabit your mind, they're going to inhabit your world. You want them to be people who you can discuss with and converse with and be with. In a way, that's more important than literal truth, right? Can I live with this person in the house of my being, so to speak, to use Heidegger's expression, right? And if you can't, then you know you just have to decide who you're going to allow in the house and who you want to just leave outside.
Right.
Now I think that's how it kind of works for me. It's like, okay, this is attractive, and I want to explore this realm of thought and feeling, and so I can go there. But now I'm not at the stage in my life where it doesn't suit my particular psychophysical apparatus or my background. So I'm not going to go into the. I'm not going to go. I'll go deep into other things. I don't need to go into. I don't need to go deep into Lacan or Hegel. I have a lot of Hegelian, Lacanian friends, and they've been pushing me in that direction. It's like, no, I go deep in the areas where I feel that I'm like a tropical fish. I have to be in the climate that suits my own particular nature.
Sure. So, Andrew, this is the 100th episode.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you know, of the Parallax View. So what have we learned, huh?
Do you want me to get out my Excel file and show you all the things we've learned and bullet points?
No, but we're talking about podcasting and hot versus cool media, and you know, the place that we inhabit within ourselves and the people that we invite in physically and metaphorically and all of these things.
Yeah. Well, we've learned that we have some friends out there, you know. We don't have millions of friends, but we have good friends.
Of millions of friends. Mm-hmm.
We don't have as many friends as Taylor Swift, but we have good company out there. I think that's a learning point. There's good company out there, and I'm surprised also that people listen to us, like people that you wouldn't expect to listen to us actually listen to us. So that's kind of cool,
right?
You know, some people are religiously following us, you know, like groupies, you know, they're just like, they listen to us and they start to rip
all the
off
emails
their
that I'm getting.
They start to masturbate in front of the screen.
Yeah, sure.
Did you know that, Tom? Are you aware of that? I've got several letters that are, you know, very disturbing, you know, and interesting at the same time.
I got several inboxes of letters, you know?
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah.
No, but it's
you
great.
You didn't put on the filters on your inbox like I did.
No. No, but we want to tweak the format a little bit, and we have like an extravaganza coming up, and your course is coming up tomorrow, no?
Yes, I should have mentioned that at the beginning. So, if anybody's listening to this, we've got a good bunch of people signed up for Bonita Roy's course called The Convivial Life, Conversation with Ivan Illich and Friends, which is going to explore Ivan Illich in a very hands-on way, not like an academic way, in the philosophy of Ivan Illich, which is very cool. I think it's all about sort of spontaneity and friendship and taking a distance from let's say the pseudo versions of these things, of friendship institutions, care, etc. It's like inspiration rather than inspiration in the moment, divine inspiration rather than, you know, your list of bullet points.
So that starts tomorrow. Can people still subscribe? Yes, no?
Of course they can. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you can subscribe the courses page on Parallax, and you can write me, in the comments.
Right. And so the course of Layman is coming up in October, also on Parallax. And then you can also subscribe to that. Then you have OG Rose's course.
Yes, OG Rose is Daniel and Michelle Gardner. They're amazing philosophers from Eastern United States who are going to further explore. We're going to further explore Ivan Illich's is thought through them and their ideas.
But that would be more like a philosophical approach.
It's called, I think, it will be slightly more philosophical, I would say, although Bonita's no slouch in terms of the philosophy. Just a minute, let me find out the name of the course, because I think
are these two courses connected with each other, Bonita's course and OG Rose's course? Do you need to do Bonita's course in order for, you know, to
they're connected in a fractal way, but not in a linear way. So you could the people who are taking, I hope some of the people who are taking Bonita's course will take this course. It's called Look at the Birds of the Air, How We Must Unplan Our Lives. I like the title as well.
Right.
About unplanning our lives, because, you know, we're a society obsessed with planning, and this idea of unplanning is very good.
Yeah.
Again, in the spirit of Ivan Illich.
Nice. Then there's a course coming up with Gurdjieff, about Gurdjieff, no? And then we have.
Yeah, we haven't laid that out yet, but that should be in January. With Luke Beckney. He's from Australia, and he's an expert in the Gurdjieff work. He's been doing Gurdjieff, what's called the work, the fourth way work. He's been deep into Gurdjieff for many, many, many years. And so we'll have a bona fide Gurdjieff course in January. That's not related to the Ivan Illich. We're moving into new territory.
Right. Also January, February, there will be a course of, you know, psychedelics and the use of psychedelics and therapy and, you know, for transformation. But this is all, you know, has to be completely designed. Yes.
So Tom, when you put out this podcast, you should put this at the beginning of the podcast, perhaps, huh?
No.
No? Okay. Let's put it out like this.
No, we already had our hot take. No,
I see. Okay.
Marketing, and now we will have another hot take, Andrew.
We're all about hot takes.
Yeah, we're hot takes. So what do you think about
hot media, hot takes, and just being hot in general?
Jordan Peterson getting re-education, huh?
Well, yeah, there we go. What do I think about that? Oh, yes. Well, it's not worth talking about. It's just so stupid, you know. It's just not worth talking about. It's not just not a subject. I think most of the culture war subjects for me are no longer worth talking about.
Right.
They're only worth talking about when they come out at first. Okay, this happened, then, oh, maybe we can talk about that. But I feel that this is just the same old thing that's always happening to Jordan Peterson, the same old story, the same old narrative. And there's so many commentaries on the subject that there's just nothing I could possibly say to add to that at all. And
can.
Go ahead. What do you think about the Italian guy kissing the girl? How about that one?
We can.
You've already covered that in your other podcast, right?
Yes.
I didn't listen to it, but.
Yeah, maybe you should.
Maybe I should.
Maybe you learned something, Andrew.
Maybe I would. So patronizing, my God. I don't know why I talk to you, Tom. You just treat me like your little bitch, don't you?
But you're the patriarch. You have to be, you know.
I'm the patriarch?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of these things?
No, I was just thinking that there's, because it harks back to what we talked before, you know, there's a history of, you know, unruly psychologists, you know?
Uh-huh.
You have, you know, it was always related to sex. You have Leary, we talked about this. Then you have Willem Reich.
R.D. Lang, he's one.
And you know, so, him? And though they got thrown into jail, you know, for being unruly in a kind of
Wilhelm
sense.
Reich and,
And so, but, you know, they took it and they didn't make big of a fuss about it. And Leary was even, you know, tricking the system with a personality test that he devised on his own. And so it's like, I don't get why.
Jordan must be under a lot of stress because he's just fighting like mad. He can't put down the gloves, you know, for 5 minutes, it would seem.
Yeah, but what seems strange to me that he's all about, you know, speaking the truth, and the whole thing doesn't seem as the truth to me.
What whole thing?
No, the whole thing that he's fighting the system because he's getting re-educated now, that's, you know, that seems not truthful. If you compare it with other unruly psychologists, you know, he should use his intelligence to be done with it instead of making a fuss about it, you know?
So he protests too much. He makes too much of a fuss. Yeah, that's true. That's just who he is. That's his nature. I think who was it? It was Jarvis Vakey says there's two Jordan Petersons. There's the one who's, you know, very insightful on subjects of psychological subjects and the Bible and mythology and anthropology and, you know, very deep, interesting observations.
Yeah.
And then there's the angry guy on Twitter. You know, and I'm not against anger. I think, you know, you should express anger at times, but it's just unrelenting for him at the moment. He just doesn't relent, you know?
Yeah.
He never stops. So he never stops the attack on Twitter going. And so it makes me feel like he's cornered in some kind of a way. And it takes away from whatever, like, you know, I have sympathy for him in terms of this court case. I mean, people should be allowed, people should be allowed to say what the fuck they think about whatever they think, you know, more or less. And I wouldn't want any government organization, you know, messing with that. But the way he attacks right now, I feel like, yeah, I really feel like he's gone into this choleric state, like this fierce, this angry state of mind that's almost constant or something. At least that's how he expresses himself on Twitter, which is kind of a shame and kind of takes away from the skill, you know, that he could have in you know, working through these issues. You know, other times he's quite reasonable, but that's my take.
He's pretentious. Anyway. I think he's pretentious when he's doing that.
I don't. I think he's just angry. I don't find him pretentious.
I find it pretentious because, you know, he should. I mean, if you just compare it with what Leary did and what Willem Reich did, you know, they found different solution instead of, you know, crying in front of the camera or angry crying, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he talks about strengths and then he makes himself the victim. It's all kind of messed up and, you know.
What about a lot of people just went insane, you know. At least he's still standing, you know. You know, you have to have sympathy for that sort of being in that kind of, I mean, he does it. He puts himself out there. But he's also subject to millions of projections and opinions and constantly, and could wreck a person, could destroy a person pretty easily. But anyway, I'm expressing the sympathy for Jordan here. But
no, but I mean, that's it's. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just saying, you know, that the right of free speech is never Absolute. They are always, you know, think.
You're
you
a German,
know.
Though, so.
No, but it's like you can't. You can't. It's not an absolute right. You know, there are always instances where the state has to protect certain truths, or, you know, for better or worse, there are always instances where you can show that, you know, the right to freedom of speech is always not absolute. And so and there are points where society, you know, there's a joke from Louis C.K., you know, when he says, if everybody tells you you're an asshole, you can't just say, oh, no, that's not me, it's you, you know, and so there's everybody has the right to voice their own opinion. But if the society or parts of society says, OK, maybe you take a step back, you know, and reevaluate, and because you're not the one who decides about the fate of our society, you know, the society has to do that. And then to say, no, it is up to me, that is pretentious.
Yeah, but have you had to take one of those university tests about, you know, whether you're a rapist or not? I've had to take those tests. They're so stupid. They're so demeaning. They're so completely removed from intelligence, right? These kind of politically correct tests, they treat you like children, you know. They don't talk to you as a human being, you know. So I can understand kind of where the rage is coming from, I think. I mean, if you look at, let's say, the way that the bureaucratization of care, as Ivan Illich would put it, is a very Maoist, you know, canceling force, you know, and I think he's subject to that. And, you know, if somebody would try to take away your profession, whether you were a, you know, billionaire or not, because of something you said on Twitter, you know, you might be a little bit upset or, you know, or enraged, I would say. But again, he is a public figure, and he's responsible for how he behaves and that sort of thing. So.
Sure. But then if you compare it to Leary, he had to take the same tests, and he used the test to, you know, play the game and not be in a victim stance. Leary never went into a victim, you know, stance, but always, you know, had moves to make. And so this is all that I'm saying, that, mm-hmm. you know, the message that Peterson is putting out is kind of, it's kind of contradictory, because he says be strong, but then he claims himself to be the victim of the system. Then he says speak the truth, but then he does the thing for clicks. And, you know, I get what you're saying. There's a truthful, insightful Peterson. And I see that too, you know. I'm not saying that this aspect is not there, but I'm saying that the other aspect, you know, this public persona, that's not completely attuned. And he's all about self-alignment.
Oh, he's not completely attuned, but who would be in his circumstances?
But he should be if you're preaching to the choir, like, what's the expression? If you're putting out a message, you should try to be as honest and authentic about that thing as you could.
Well, I think he tries to do that. Maybe he doesn't, maybe he fails a lot, that's all. You know, or maybe he's just been pushed over the edge so many times that maybe he's been captured by his audience, and maybe he's become a persona,
rather than, which would be pretentious. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, I wouldn't accuse him I would accuse him of perhaps. I don't think I think he tries his best to be authentic anyway, even if he's pretentious at times. Yeah. But
no, I get
anyway,
what
I'm more forgiving of him than you are. That's all.
No, it's just, no. If you look, I'm not judging him as a human being. We're all struggling, right?
Yeah,
I'm not talking about this kind of thing, about this level. I'm talking about his public persona, and he chooses to play that game. And if you choose to play that game, you have to be judged by the game you're playing, right? Mm-hmm. And that's all that I'm saying. I'm not talking about the person that's cooking dinner for his family, right? I'm talking about the person who wears a two-colored suit, you know, and cries in front of the camera. You know, there's two different things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. But again, to defend him, who else cries in front of the camera? Nobody ever expresses emotion. If people are so lost in their persona, maybe there's an authenticity to that. I mean, having actual emotion, you know, in front of a camera, like nobody does that. So
you never have the feeling that he uses that, you know, to make a point. Is it, you know, it's like there's always something off. It seems like a performance at times.
I don't know.
No?
I don't know.
No, I don't know either. We're just talking impressions, you know, intuitions.
Well, like when he cries, I think the times that I've seen him cry, it's usually over young guys that he meets and you know, and it's kind of like, what the fuck is going on? And he starts, maybe he's seeing himself in there a bit. It seems like a genuine moment to me.
Yeah.
But I sometimes, at the moment, his Twitter attacks seem to be like, he seems to have gone a little bit into the, like, into a permanent state of anger. And that's the critique I would have, not of his expressing vulnerability or whatever. Even if, I don't know if it's a fake vulnerability or not, like maybe he's, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's fake. But maybe he doesn't have control over that in certain moments. And
I mean, I Robert Anton Wilson and the question of what is fake, you know, Orson Welles. I always mm-hmm. love that, because I mean, I think he writes about that in Cosmic Trigger Part 3, you know, about the documentary about F is for Fake from, you know, Orson Welles and all these writers and painters that are able to paint in the style of Picasso and are like mm-hmm. venerated, you know, before it came out as great painters, but these pictures are fake. So how what is fake? What that mean? And you know, the idea of, you know, fake performance, and when do they get real? And I always find that super interesting.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes fake is more real than fake real. Like when somebody is so theatrical and unreal that there's a transparency to that, that it's more real than somebody who has this sort of earnest, like Bruce Springsteen always has this earnest working class guy thing, which is totally fake, right?
Right.
Some, you know, in some way, his music is very authentic. I find his music very authentic, even though it's fake.
Right.
There's something, he is authentic and he does make you feel with his music. And you might think that you were a working class guy and, you know, waking up to go and work at the car factory, but Bruce Springsteen, you're living in a mansion in New Jersey. It's fake, but it's, maybe it's real just through empathy or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Because we were talking about Lacan, there's a concept, and it seems to me that even Zizek is struggling with that in this context of fakeness and performance and realness. And he talks about, you know, the idea of the real in Lacan. And he doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the physical world or that what you can see. It's way more elusive, the real.
It's without the symbolic or the imaginary. It's when the symbolic and the imaginary kind of fall away, right?
It seems as something...
That's the real.
No, it's, you know, yeah. It seems he seems to point to archetypes that are energetically charged, you know, in mm-hmm. our language, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, it's, you know, in terms of what is fake, what is true. But if there is, you know, an archetype that is charged, that is something real, because that is changing all these different spheres that you're engaged in, you know, the imaginary, the symbolic and the real world. You get what I'm saying? So for example, if we're talking about Leary and Peterson, so there was a time when everybody in the society was not able to look away what Peterson was doing, you know, before his crisis, you know? So there was a moment when he actually shifted the whole thing, the whole cultural self description, self-perception. And that was an archetype that was charged, and to charge to a degree that nobody could look away, and everybody had opinions, right?
Yeah.
And then the crisis happened, and what I perceive now is that the archetype is not that charged anymore. If he's charged,
yeah, I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that is what the, and so that's not real anymore. And the Lacanian sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I always think of what Johnny Rotten said about the Sex Pistols reunion. He says it's like a Civil War reenactment.
Right. Right.
So it's like Jordan Peterson is doing this Civil War reenactment all the time, you know.
Right.
His moment of being the charged archetype or being this is kind of over. His moment, yes, of being the Sex Pistols is over, right?
Right.
His moments of this, whoa, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
That's over. And now he's become a kind of a caricature of himself that people, you know, in the public eye.
Right.
Right. So people, you know, project, you know, he's just become, so whatever reaction to him you have is sort of a stereotypical reaction at this point. It's not a genuine reaction.
Right.
You know, that's why I don't write about him anymore. You know, when he first came out, I wrote lots of articles about him. I was trying to figure out what was going on here. But
yes.
At a certain point, I stopped writing about him because I felt like the archetype wasn't there anymore. I still listen to his podcasts and sort of enjoy what he has to say at times, but I don't have that. I don't feel like there's any, it's something that needs to be reacted to at the moment, which is why when you asked me about, you know, this thing, it's just like, okay, this is just another boring culture war issue that people make to, you know, a big deal about. Might be a big deal for him, and probably the issues are important, but.
No, but that's the interesting thing, when and how a society moves because somebody is inhabited by a charged archetype. It's like, and then, you know, and then it's like some people, you know, if the light goes out, some people have the decency to kill themselves, like Kurt Cobain or whatever.
This is what you would like Jordan to do?
No.
I'm just kidding. I'm just teasing.
Or they fade away. But it's just like you can see, if you listen to a podcast, you can see and you feel.
Yeah.
If there's something, or you know, if there's something real in a Lacanian sense going on, like,
that's
or
good.
because there's like this, there was this new podcast between Weinstein and this super successful young guy, Chris, whatever. And it's like, there's nothing there. It's interesting to a certain degree, but only to the degree that Weinstein has worked on his storytelling and tells the stories that he previously told in other places in a kind of different way. But there's not the real archetype in that podcast manifesting itself. It's very well produced. It looks good and it's accessible and it's easy digestive, like talking about Marshall McLuhan. And it's like, yeah, but it's like you're not in, really engaged. It's
the
like
real
not...
is no longer present, for sure. Yeah, because you know, I mean, I think a lot of those intellectual deep web guys were just kind of running off the charisma of Jordan in a way. And so I respect Brett Weinstein and his brother, because his brother really sticks to his guns in terms of what he believes with the Dark Horse.
Yeah.
and he was willing to take a stand that nobody else was taking, and now people are starting to know that he was right, you know, whereas
right.
A lot of other people like Sam Harris kind of were just repeating, you know, the super ego injunction, whereas Brett was being very honest.
But Sam Harris was hot. I mean, like also like in the
New Atheist world.
Yeah, exactly, with Hitchens. And so that was, and that was a moment when there was like, I mean, they were literally called the Four New Horsemen, because there was an archetype that was charged, and they moved the whole climate. In the it was the Clinton years, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the ancient cult of materialism was arising from the depths to declare that, you know, God was dead or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and now he's an institution. Now these guys are all become institutions, right?
Yeah,
everybody
but
becomes, when people become an institution, they're dead. This is very Ivan Illich. Like he's always criticizing the institution as being a simulacrum of the real inspiration, real divine
right.
inspiration.
Yes. Yes.
You know?
Yes. And so that's what the, yeah. Mm-hmm, go ahead.
No, you please.
No, but that's what Lacan, I, as far as I understand now, that's what I understand what Lacan's means, the real, you know, the thing that moves, which is not really graspable. It's like, it's very subtle to see, but it's more real than the real world, if you get what I mean. And so there's
or
like
more real than than what we're supposed to think the real world is, than whatever right. the symbolic version of the real world is.
Yes.
I guess Jordan becomes a symbolic version of himself, and Sam becomes a symbolic version of Sam Harris, and all these guys become, Noam Chomsky becomes a symbolic of just a certain, you know, anarchist left point of view. Jordan becomes a symbolic of a kind of conservative reactionary view, and everybody becomes a symbolic version of themselves.
And then,
you know, the real is gone. Yeah, I haven't delved into it, but what's the imaginary? Is the imaginary the point of contact between the real and the symbolic? Or
for example, it is the ideal that you have about yourself, for example.
The ideal, yeah.
And the, you know, for example, like in terms of psychoanalysis, you know, it's like one instance.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, that
pathos. It would have pathos to it. In other words, it has real real gravitas, but it can't be grasped, and it can't be framed, it can't be packaged, it can't be institutionalized, it can't be, you know,
what can
the real,
right?
And all of that.
And so if divine spark, as you called it from Illich, if that divine spark fails, you know, these structures, the symbolic structures, get kind of calcified, and then they're becoming, you know, copies of themselves, and develop this, like in an instance with Sam Harris, it's these kinds of weird perspectives and these calcified perspectives that are not really attuned to the fine structures of society anymore.
Yeah, because it's about being attuned, isn't it? It's about keeping your attention. Yeah. You know, I remember, like, Gurdjieff would say that you could even write a book and be completely asleep. You know, you could write an entire book, but you're not attuned at all to anything.
Right.
Except conceptual verbiage and cliches even you could even be very elaborate, but you can tell a book that is attuned and a book that is just a repetition. You know, a lot of it happens to a lot of authors, right? Doesn't it? They they write a few early books that are super powerful.
Yeah.
And then they just, I think it happened to Henry Miller too. They just kind of repeat a different version of themselves, and everything is a footnote to what they did before.
Yeah, or it's the other way around, that they never find, like Nietzsche, any kind of audience. And then the whole society kind of moves around it till everything kind of clicks from one moment to another. You know, that also happens, you know, when suddenly all of these works are relevant after his death.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting how time affects our perception, right? It's like how we think of something. You know, in the 70s is different than how we think of it now, completely different. So whatever we thought of the Rolling Stones in the 70s is something completely different from how we think of them now. Or I was thinking about somebody like, and then there's these artists who have something true and authentic and beautiful that nobody gets at all. Nobody understands it, you know, and then they die miserable and alone, like Nick Drake or something. And then later on, you know, somebody else discovers this and says it's beautiful. And then people are like, holy shit, what do we just, missed out here on Nick Drake and Van Gogh and whoever else. Yeah.
I like the Twitter account from Niklas Taleb. Not when he disses people, but when he talks about books, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So he's like, it's one of his things that he talks about, you know, mechanics of book writing and marketing. And so he says, like, one thing that he says is that technically you don't need to promote a book, because if it has something, it's like, I'm rephrasing that in my own
words now.
But if it has something true to it, it will find its audience.
Yeah. If there's something powerful in it, it has its own momentum and its own, you know, power.
Right.
So it doesn't need to be propped up or exaggerated, or, you know, people just, I agree. I mean, there are instances where where something does get propped up by, and you're just, the artist becomes kind of lucky. But I think mostly artists don't know what they're doing, you know. They don't have an overview of what they're doing. I mean, really good artists, they just have no clue about the overview. They're just so involved in the substance of what they're doing. They need guys, you know, to discover them, or to promote them, or to, because they're almost blind to the world because they're so absorbed in the task of what they're creating.
Absolutely. That's why I find this whole we need more leaders or we need more visionaries kind of so preposterous, because one of the mechanisms of the whole, thing is that you have to be unaware of the processes that shape you in order to create something new. You can't be like fully aware, like about the mechanisms that put you in a certain place in order to create something new. You have to be like completely
Because it's
yeah.
not you, it's the archetype,
Yes.
right?
Yes.
That takes hold of you. So any kind of, if you try to construct that, you just end up making a fake monument of something.
Right,
You
exactly.
just have to be attuned to the archetype, and that's a mysterious process. We can't quantify it. We can't analyze it. We can't apply our marketing to it even. You know, it's like it's impossible to understand or quantify or
Yeah.
measure.
Yeah.
So it's a very, again, it's a completely, it's totally mysterious, I would say.
Yeah.
And then, so you need a guy named John Hammond who can see who Bob Dylan is when nobody else can.
Yeah.
They just see this whiny, this guy, this little brat with a whiny voice who's copying Woody Guthrie and is super annoying. The most annoying, fake performer in all of, oh, this guy's got something, right? It's very rare that people can actually notice that
Yeah.
about an artist, right? It's
Yeah.
not rare for somebody to construct a Taylor Swift, because in a way Taylor Swift is kind of a constructed, like you just she's like an AI created artist. But even that is not entirely true, because she must have some little something that is, connected.
I don't know, but what I find interesting is like because we were starting this conversation about the relationship the reader has to the text, and then it's about guessing. And there are like, and there has to be, I'm sorry, there has to be something in the text that proves, to you that it is written by an archetype, although you don't understand it. And so there has to be, I don't know what it is, but you're guessing, the text has to elicit a certain form of guessing that keeps you guessing and keeps you like engaged with
Yes,
something
yes.
to make itself valuable. I don't know how to describe that.
Again, this is why logos is overrated, right? In some sense. I mean,
What?
logos in the
Yeah.
sense that Alexander uses as logic is somewhat overrated. Like, you don't read a book because it's accurate or true or realistic, or corresponds to your whatever you believe in, or is politically correct or religiously correct or correct, or coherent, or even, or any of those things. The logos is, it doesn't have to hang together. It doesn't have to be coherent. It doesn't have to mean anything. It doesn't have to, all of those things are very overrated when it comes to art. Just
Yeah.
like IQ is overrated when it comes to intelligence. It's sort of just a purely autistic way of looking at intelligence, right? It's like, oh, this person, again, this is the Sam Harris thing. Sam Harris has probably a very high IQ, but he's not tuned in. So he's not tuned into a deeper intelligence, a divine intelligence, I would call it even. But he's not tuned. But being tuned into it, that intelligence is not. It's not. It's not. It's again. It's I guess it's pathic, using Bardian language, and unpredictable and mercurial and strange and. And we just, oh, what's that? And then we're curious, and we want to fill things in, and that's the act. We're actively engaged in the work because it's not all spelled out for us. Because if it was all spelled out for us, then we'd just be, we'd be doing this kind of eternal repetition of something that tells us what we already know about what we already know.
The interesting thing with Sloterdijk is that he says a good chunk of our culture is to try to tame the untamable. Because you know, it's like the human impulse is, oh no, I want to have that. I want to be that. I want to enact an archetype, but that never works. But still, it's such a driving force for everything that we do, you know. So we are like
exactly.
in this, and it's
that's amazing.
Eternal elusive, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, so I can feel that. I can feel that within myself. You want to create something. You want to do this great podcast or make this amazing song, or and you so you're like, how do I do that? How do I do that? How do I do that? And there's no way to figure that out, like in a formulaic manner. And somebody might be able to figure it out, you know, but then whatever they figure out is a simulacrum.
Yeah,
it's not the real thing, because the real thing is always incredibly bizarre and mysterious, and we don't know why. We don't know why Nick Drake's music is beautiful, and Ooh. We don't know why. It's just strange. Nick, you don't know Drake? Nick Drake?
No.
Oh, he has this. He was a singer-songwriter from the 70s who committed suicide, and he sort of invented this way of playing guitar and singing that's very haunting and beautiful. He was kind of rediscovered by people in the 90s like Kurt Cobain, and they were influenced by him. And he was totally mostly unknown in his whole life. He was this English folk singer named Nick Drake. He played sort of strange tunings on guitars and had this very sad music, very depressing,
yeah,
and but weirdly beautiful.